Second Treatise of Government by John Locke, first published in 1689. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Chapters 6 and 7. Chapter 6. Paternal Power. You may think that a work like the present one is not the place for complaints about words and names that have become current, but I think it won't be amiss to offer new words when the old ones are apt to lead men into mistakes. The phrase paternal power is probably an example of this. It seems to place the power of parents over their children wholly in the father, as though the mother had no share in it, whereas reason and revelation both tell us that she has an equal title. Might it not be better to call it parental power? Whatever obligations are laid on children by nature, and the right of generation must bind them equally to each of the causes of their being generated. And accordingly we see in both the Old and New Testaments that the positive law of God everywhere joins the parents together without distinction when it commands the obedience of children. Had just this one thing been thought about properly, even without going any deeper, it might have kept men from running into the gross mistakes they have made about this power of parents. When under the label paternal power, it seemed to belong only to the father. It could be described as absolute dominion and as regal authority, without seeming ridiculous. But those phrases would have sounded strange, and in the very name shown the absurdity of the doctrine in question. If this supposed absolute power over children had been called parental, for that would have given away the fact that it belonged to the mother too. Those who contend so much for the absolute power and authority of fatherhood, as they call it, will be in difficulties if the mother is given any share in it. The monarchy they contend for wouldn't be well supported if the very name showed that the fundamental authority from which they want to derive their government by only a single person belonged not to one person, but to two. But no more about names. I said in Chapter 2 that all men are by nature equal, but of course I didn't mean equality in all respects. Age or virtue may put some men above others. Excellence of ability and merit may raise others above the common level. Some may naturally owe deference to others because of their birth, or from gratitude because of benefits they have received, or for other reasons. But all this is consistent with the equality that all men have in respect of jurisdiction or dominion over one another. That was the equality I spoke of in Chapter 2, the equality that is relevant to the business in hand, namely the equal right that every man has to his natural freedom, without being subjected to the will or authority of any other man. I acknowledge that children are not born in this state of full equality, though they are born to it. Their parents have a sort of rule and jurisdiction over them when they come into the world, and for some time after that, but it's only a temporary one. The bonds of this subjection are like the swaddling clothes they are wrapped up in, and supported by, in the weakness of their infancy. As the child grows up, age and reason loosen the ties, until at last they drop off altogether and leave a man to his own devices. Adam was created as a complete man, his body and mind in full possession of their strength and reason, so he was able from the first instant of his coming into existence to provide for his own support and survival, and to govern his actions according to the dictates of the law of reason that God had implanted in him. The world has been populated with his descendants, who are all born infants, weak and helpless, without knowledge or understanding. To make up for the defects of this incomplete state, until the improvement of growth and age has removed them, Adam and Eve, and all parents after them, were obliged by the law of nature to preserve, nourish, and bring up the children they had begotten, not as their own workmanship, but as the workmanship of their own Maker, the Almighty God, to whom they were to be accountable for them. The law that was to govern Adam was the very one that was to govern all his posterity, namely, the law of reason. But his offspring entered the world differently from him, namely, by natural birth, which brought them out ignorant and without the use of reason. So they were not immediately under the law of reason, because nobody can be under a law that hasn't been made known to him. And this law is made known only by reason, so that someone who hasn't come to the use of his reason can't be said to be under it. Law, properly understood, is not so much the limitation as the direction of a free and intelligent agent to his proper interest, and doesn't prescribe anything that isn't for the general good of those under that law. If men could be happier without it, the law would be a useless thing, and would inevitably vanish. Don't think of the law as confining. It is wrong to label as confinement something that hedges us in only from bogs and precipices. So, however much people may get this wrong, what law is for is not to abolish or restrain freedom, but to preserve and enlarge it. For in all the states of created beings who are capable of laws, where there is no law, there is no freedom. Liberty is freedom from restraint and violence by others, and this can't be had where there is no law. This freedom is not, as some say it is, a freedom for every man to do whatever he wants to do. For who could be free if every other man's whims might dominate him? Rather, it is a freedom to dispose in any way he wants of his person, his actions, his possessions, and his whole property, not to be subject in any of this to the arbitrary will of anyone else, but freely to follow his own will, all within whatever limits are set by the laws he is under. So the power that parents have over their children arises from their duty to take care of their offspring during the imperfect state of childhood. What the children need, and what the parents are obliged to provide, is the forming of their minds and the governing of their actions while the children are still young and ignorant. When reason comes into play, the parents are released from that trouble. God gave man an understanding to direct his actions, and fitting in with that, allowed him a freedom of will and of acting within the limits set by the law he is under. But while he is in a condition in which he hasn't enough understanding of his own to direct his will, he is not to have any will of his own to follow. The person who understands for him must will for him too. That person must prescribe to his will and regulate his actions. But when he reaches the condition that made his father a freeman, the son is a freeman too. This holds in all the laws a man is under, whether natural or civil. Let us look at these separately. If a man is under the law of nature, what made him free under that law? What gave him freedom to dispose of his property according to his own will, within the limits set by that law? I answer, a state of maturity, in which he might be supposed to be capable of knowing that law, so that he could keep his actions within the limits set by it. When he has entered that state, he is presumed to know how far that law is to be his guide, and how far he may make use of his freedom, and so he comes to have that freedom. Until then, he must be guided by someone else, who is presumed to know how far the law allows a liberty. If such a state of reason, such an age of discretion, made him free, the same state will make his son free too. If a man is under the law of England, what made him free under that law? That is, what gave him the liberty to dispose of his actions and possessions as he wishes, within the limits of what that law allows? I answer, a capacity for knowing that law. A capacity which the law itself supposes to be present at the age of 21, and in some cases sooner. If this made the father free, it will make the son free too. Until then, the law allows the son to have no will. He is to be guided by the will of his father or guardian, who is to do his understanding for him. And if the father dies, and fails to substitute a deputy in his place, or if he doesn't provide a tutor to govern his son while he is a minor, and doesn't yet have an adult understanding, the law takes care to do it. Someone else must govern him, and be a will to him until he has reached a state of freedom, and his understanding has become fit to take over the government of his will. But after that, the father and son are equally free, as are a tutor and his pupil, after the pupil has grown up. They are equally subjects of the same law together, and the father has no remaining dominion over the life, liberty, or estate of his son. This holds, whether they are only in the state of nature and under its law, or under the positive laws of an established government. But if, through defects that happen out of the ordinary course of nature, someone never achieves a degree of reason that would enable him to know the law, and so to live within the rules of it, he is never capable of being a free man. He is never allowed freely to follow his own will, because he doesn't have the understanding that is the will's proper guide, but continues under the tuition and government of others for as long as his own understanding is incapable of taking over. And so lunatics and idiots are never freed from the government of their parents. Thus we are born free, as we are born rational. Not that we as newborn babies can actually exercise either. Age that brings reason brings freedom along with it. So we see how natural freedom is consistent with subjection to parents, both being based on the same principle. A child is free by his father's title, by his father's understanding, which is to govern him till he has understanding of his own. The freedom of a mature man, and the subjection of a not yet mature child to his parents, are so consistent with one another, and so distinguishable, that they cannot be run together, even by the most blinded and obstinate defenders of the thesis, that the rights of monarchs somehow come from the rights of fathers. As for determining when a man can be said to have achieved enough use of reason to be capable of understanding and obeying those laws whereby he is then bound, this, says the judicious Richard Hooker, is a great deal easier to tell by experience of particular cases than to lay down in general theoretical terms. Commonwealths themselves allow that there is an age at which men are to begin to act like free men, so that before that age they aren't required to take oaths of allegiance, or in any other way to declare the authority of the government of their countries. So a man's freedom, his liberty of acting according to his own will, is based on his having reason, which can instruct him in the law he is to govern himself by, and make him know to what extent he is left to the freedom of his own will. To turn him loose and give him complete liberty before he has reason to guide him is not allowing him his natural privilege of being free. Rather, it is pushing him out among the lower animals, and abandoning him to a state as wretched and subhuman as theirs is. This is what gives parents the authority to govern their children while they are minors. God has made it their business to take care of their offspring in this way, and has built into them tendencies to gentleness and concern, so as to moderate this power, so that they will use the power for as long as the children need to be under it for the children's good. But what reason can there be to expand the care that parents owe to their offspring into an absolute arbitrary command of the father? In fact, a father's power reaches only far enough to impose the discipline that he finds effective in giving his children the strong and healthy bodies and vigorous and right-thinking minds that will best fit them to be most useful to themselves and others. And, if it is necessary, in the family circumstances, to make them work, when they are able, for their own livelihood. But in this power, the mother too has her share with the father. Indeed, the father is so far from having this power by a special right of nature, rather than having it as the guardian of his children, that when his care of them comes to an end, so does his power over them. That power is inseparably tied to their nourishment and upbringing, and it belongs as much to the foster father of an abandoned baby as to the natural father of another child. But though in due course a child comes to be as free from subjection to the will and command of his father as the father himself is free from subjection to the will of anyone else, and each of them is under only the restraints that also bind the other, from the law of nature and from the civil law of their country, this freedom that the son has doesn't exempt him from honouring his parents, as he is required to do by the law of God and nature. Having made the parents serve as instruments in his great design of continuing the race of mankind, God laid on them an obligation to nourish, preserve, and bring up their offspring, and also laid on children a perpetual obligation to honour their parents. This honour involves an inward esteem and reverence, to be shown by all outward expressions, so it holds the child back from anything that might ever injure or offend, disturb or endanger, the happiness or life of those from whom he received his own life, and draws him into doing all he can for the defence, relief, assistance, and comfort of those by whose means he came into existence, and has been made capable of enjoying life. No state, and no kind of freedom, can free children from this obligation. But this is very far from giving parents a power of command over their children, or an authority to make laws, and dispose as they please of the children's lives or liberties. It is one thing to be owed honour, respect, gratitude, and assistance, another to require absolute obedience and submission. Consider these two facts. While a child is a minor, its father is temporarily in the position of a governor, a position that ends when the child becomes an adult. The child's duty of honour gives the parents a perpetual right to respect, reverence, support, and compliance too, in proportion to how much care, cost, and kindness the father has put into the child's upbringing. This doesn't end with minority, but holds throughout a man's life. The failure to distinguish these two powers, namely the father's right of upbringing during minority, and the parent's right to be honoured throughout his life, may have caused a great part of the mistakes about power and parentage. They are utterly different from one another. Strictly speaking, the first of them is not really a right of parental power, but rather a privilege of children, and a duty of parents. The nourishment and education of their children is so much a duty of parents that nothing can absolve them from performing it. And though the power of commanding and punishing children goes along with the duty, God has woven into the forces at work in human nature such a tenderness for offspring that there is little risk of parents using their power too severely. In addition to the powers of privileges discussed above, there is another power that a father ordinarily has, which gives him a hold on the obedience of his children. Although men in general have this power, the occasions for using it are nearly always within the private lives of families. It seldom shows up anywhere else, and when it does, it isn't much noticed, which is why it is generally taken to be a part of paternal jurisdiction. What I'm talking about is the power men generally have to leave their estates to those who please them best. Children can expect to inherit from their father, usually in certain proportions, according to the law and custom of the country. But the father commonly has the power to make bequests with a more or less generous hand, depending on how much each child has behaved in ways that he has agreed with and liked. This gives a considerable hold on the obedience of children, and it connects with something that has been a main topic of this treatise, namely the place of consent in government. I shall explain. The enjoyment of land always involves submitting to the government of the country where the land is. Now, it has commonly been supposed that a father could give his offspring a binding obligation to submit to the government of which he himself was a subject. But this is wrong. The obligation to submit to a government is only a condition of owning the land. And the inheritance of an estate, that is, under that government, reaches only those who will accept the estate when it has that condition attached to it. So it is not a natural tie or obligation, but a voluntary submission. Every man's children are by nature as free as the man himself, or any of his ancestors ever were, and while they are in that freedom, they may choose what society they will join themselves to, what commonwealth they will submit to. But if they want to enjoy the inheritance of their ancestors, they must take it on the terms on which their ancestors had it, and submit to all the conditions tied to such ownership. So this power does indeed enable fathers to oblige their children to obedience to themselves, even when they are adults, and most commonly to subject their children to this or that political power. But neither of these comes from any special right of fatherhood, but rather from owning the means to enforce and reward such compliance with the father's wishes, or with the laws of the Commonwealth. It is just the power that a Frenchman has over an Englishman who hopes to inherit his estate. That hope certainly creates a strong tie on his obedience to the Frenchman. And if the estate is left to him, he can enjoy it only on the conditions attached to the possession of land in the country that contains it, whether it be France or England. Despite all this, we can see how easy it was at certain times and places for the father of the family to become its monarch. This would be so when the world was young, and also today in some places where the low population makes it possible for the families of the next generation to spread out into the surrounding countryside and make homes for themselves in unoccupied territory. That creates a situation in which a considerable number of people in a line of descent from a single living person, the father, are spread out across a considerable territory. Without some government, it would be hard for them to live together, and their common father had been a ruler from the beginning of the infancy of his children. So the adult children were most likely, whether explicitly or by tacit consent, to have him continue as ruler. The only change from the earlier state of affairs is that they permitted the father, and no one else in his family, to have the executive power of the law of nature, a power that every free man naturally has, and by that permission giving him a monarchical power while they remained in that family. But this monarchical power within the extended family didn't come from any paternal right, but purely from the consent of the adult offspring. Suppose that a foreigner comes into the family's territory by chance or on business, and while there kills a member of the family. No one doubts that in such a case the father may condemn the foreigner and punish him, with death or in some other way, just as he could punish an offence by one of his children. Now, in punishing the foreigner, he can't be exercising any paternal authority, because the foreigner is not his child, so he must be acting by virtue of the executive power of the law of nature, which he had a right to, not as a father, but just as a man. Any of his adult children would also have had such a natural right, if they hadn't laid it aside and chosen to allow this dignity and authority to belong to the father and to no one else in the family. Thus, it was easy, almost natural, and virtually inevitable, for children to give their tacit consent to the father's having authority and government. They had been accustomed in their childhood to follow his direction, and to refer their little differences to him. When they were grown up, who would be fitter to rule them? They hadn't much property, or much envy of one another's goods, so their little differences hadn't become much bigger. Where could they find a fitter umpire than he by whose care they had all been sustained and brought up, and who had a tenderness for them all? Thus the natural fathers of families gradually became their politic monarchs as well. And when they happened to live long, and to have able and worthy heirs, they laid the foundations for kingdoms, whether hereditary or elective, with various different kinds of constitutions and procedures, shaped by the effects of chance, contrivance, and particular events. But if monarchs are entitled to their thrones because of their rights as fathers, and if the natural right of fathers to political authority is shown by the mere fact that government has commonly been exercised by fathers, then by the very same inference we can prove that all monarchs, and indeed only monarchs, should be priests, since it is as certain that in the beginning the father of the family was his household's priest as that he was its ruler. Chapter 7. Political or Civil Society. God having made man as a creature who, in God's own judgment, ought not to be alone, drew him strongly, by need, convenience, and inclination, into society, and equipped him with understanding and language to maintain and enjoy it. The first society was between man and wife, which gave rise to the society between parents and children, to which in time the society between master and servant came to be added. All these could and often did meet together, and constitute a single family or household in which the master or mistress had some appropriate sort of authority. Each of these smaller societies, or all together, fell short of being a political society, as we shall see if we consider the different ends, ties, and bounds of each of them. Conjugal society is made by a voluntary compact between man and woman. It mainly consists in the togetherness of bodies and right of access to one another's bodies needed for procreation, which is its main purpose. But it brings with it mutual support and assistance, and a togetherness of interests too, this being needed to unite their care and affection, and also needed by their offspring, who have a right to be nourished and maintained by them until they are old enough to provide for themselves. The purpose of bonding between male and female is not just procreation, but the continuation of the species, meaning that it's not just to have children, but to bring them up. So this link between male and female ought to last beyond procreation, for as so long as is needed for the nourishment and support of the young ones. This rule that our infinite wise Maker has imposed on his creatures can be seen to be regularly obeyed by the lower animals. In viviparous animals that feed on grass, the bonding of male with female lasts no longer than the mere act of copulation. Because the female's teat is sufficient to nourish the young until they can feed on grass, all the male has to do is to impregnate the female, and doesn't concern himself with the female or with the young, to whose nourishment he can't contribute anything. But in beasts of prey, the conjunction lasts longer, because the female isn't able to survive and to nourish her numerous offspring by her own prey alone, this being a more laborious way of living than feeding on grass, as well as a more dangerous one. So the male has to help to maintain their common family, which can't survive unaided until the young are able to hunt on their own behalf. This can be seen also with birds. Which brings us to what I think is the chief reason, if not the only reason, why the human male and female are bonded together for longer than other creatures. It is this. Long before a human child is able to shift for itself without help from its parents, its mother can again conceive and bear another child, so that the father, who is bound to take care of those he has begotten, is obliged to continue in conjugal society with the same woman, for longer than some other creatures. With creatures whose young can make their own way before the time of procreation comes around again, the conjugal bond automatically dissolves, and the parents are at liberty, till Hymen, the god of marriage, summons them again to choose new mates at his usual anniversary season. We have to admire the wisdom of the great Creator, having given man foresight and an ability to make preparations for the future, as well as dealing with present needs. God made it necessary that the society of man and wife should be more lasting than that of male and female among other creatures, so that their industry might be encouraged and their interests better united to make provision for their shared offspring, an arrangement that would be mightily disturbed if the offspring had an uncertain mixture of parentage, or if conjugal society were often and easily dissolved. But though there are these ties that make conjugal bonds firmer and more lasting in humans than in the other species of animals, it is still reasonable to ask, once procreation and upbringing have been secured, and inheritance arranged for, why shouldn't this compact between man and wife be like any other voluntary compact? That is, why shouldn't its continuance depend on the consent of the parties, or on the elapsing of a certain period of time, or on some other condition? It is a reasonable question, because neither the compact itself, nor the purposes for which it was undertaken, require that it should always be for life. Though the husband and wife have a single common concern, they have different views about things, and so inevitably will sometimes differ in what they want to be done. The final decision on any practical question has to rest with someone, and it naturally falls to the man's share, because he is the abler and stronger of the two. But this applies only to things in which they have a common interest or ownership. It leaves the wife in the full and free possession of what by contract is her special right. and gives the husband no more power over her life than she has over his. The husband's power is so far from that of an absolute monarch that the wife is in many cases free to separate from him, where natural right or their contract allows it, whether that contract is made by themselves in the state of nature, or made by the customs or laws of the country they live in. When such a separation occurs, the children go to the father or to the mother, depending on what their contract says. All the purposes of marriage can be achieved under political government as well as in the state of nature, so the civil magistrate doesn't interfere with any of the husband's or wife's rights or powers that are naturally necessary for those purposes, namely procreation and mutual support and assistance while they are together. He comes into the picture only when called upon to decide any controversy that may arise between man and wife about the purposes in question. As for the society between parents and children, and the distinct rights and powers belonging to each, I discuss this fully enough in Chapter 6, and needn't say more about it here. I think it is obvious that it is very different from politic society. Master and servant are names as old as history, but very different relationships can be characterized by them. A free man may make himself a servant to someone else by selling to him, for a specified time, the service that he undertakes to do in exchange for wages he is to receive. This often puts him into the household of his master, and under its ordinary discipline, but it gives the master a power over him that is temporary, and no greater than what is contained in the contract between them. But there is another sort of servant, to which we give the special name, slave. A slave is someone who, being a captive taken in a just war, is by the right of nature subjected to the absolute command and arbitrary power of his master. A slave has forfeited his life, and with it his liberty. He has lost all his goods, and as a slave he is not capable of having any property. So he can't, in his condition of slavery, be considered as any part of civil society, the chief purpose of which is the preservation of property. Let us then consider a master of a family, with all these subordinate relations of wife, children, servants, and slaves, all brought together under the general label of the domestic rule of a family. This may look like a little commonwealth in its structure and rules, but it is really far from that in its constitution, its power, and its purpose. How a family or any other society of men differs from a political society, properly so called, we shall best see by considering what political society is. As I have shown, a man is born with the right to perfect freedom, and with an uncontrolled enjoyment of all the rights and privileges of the law of nature, equally with any other man or men in the world. So he has by nature a power not only to preserve his property, that is, his life, liberty, and possessions, against harm from other men, but to judge and punish breaches of the law of nature by others, punishing in the manner he thinks the offence deserves, even punishing with death those crimes that he thinks are dreadful enough to deserve it. But no political society can exist or survive without having in itself the power to preserve the property, and therefore to punish the offences of all the members of that society. And so there can't be a political society except where every one of the members has given up this natural power, passing it into the hands of the community in all cases. With all private judgments of every particular member of the society being excluded, the community comes to be the umpire. It acts in this role according to settled standing rules, impartially, the same to all parties, acting through men who have authority from the community to apply those rules. This umpire settles all the disputes that may arise between members of the society concerning any matter of right, and punishes offences that any member has committed against the society, with penalties that the law has established. This makes it easy to tell who are members of a political society and who are not. Those who are united into one body, with a common established law and judiciary to appeal to, with authority to decide controversies, and punish offenders, are in civil society with one another, whereas those who have no such common appeal, I mean no such appeal here on earth, are still in the state of nature, each having to judge and to carry out the sentence, because there isn't anyone else to do those things for him. That's how it comes about that the Commonwealth has the power of making laws, that is, the power to set down what punishments are appropriate for what crimes that members of the society commit, and the power of war and peace, that is, the power to punish any harm done to any of its members by anyone who isn't a member, all this being done for the preservation of the property, that is, the life, liberty, and possessions of all the members of the society as far as possible. Every man who has entered into civil society has thereby relinquished his power to punish offences against the law of nature on the basis of his own private judgment, giving it to the legislature in all cases. And along with that, he has also given to the Commonwealth a right to call on him to employ his force for the carrying out of its judgments, which are really his own judgments, for they are made by himself or by his representative. So we have the distinction between the legislative and executive powers of civil society. The former are used to judge, by standing laws, how far offences committed within the Commonwealth are to be punished. The latter are used to determine, by occasional judgments based on particular circumstances, how far the Commonwealth should go in revenging itself for harms from outside, each of these employing all the force of all its members when there is a need for it. Thus, there is a political, or civil, society when and only when a number of men are united into one society, in such a way that each of them forgoes his executive power of the law of nature, giving it over to the public. And this comes about wherever a number of men in the state of nature enter into society to make one people, one body politic, under one supreme government. When someone joins himself to a commonwealth already in existence, he authorizes the society, that is, authorizes its legislature, to make laws for him as the public good of the society shall require. This takes men out of a state of nature into the state of a commonwealth, by setting up a judge on earth with authority to settle all the controversies and redress the harms done to any member of the Commonwealth. Any group of men with no such decisive power to appeal to are still in the state of nature, no matter what other kind of association they have with one another. This makes it evident that absolute monarchy, which some people regard as the only genuine government in the world, is actually inconsistent with civil society, and so can't be a form of civil government at all. Consider what civil society is for. It is set up to avoid and remedy the drawbacks of the state of nature that inevitably follow from every man's being judge in his own case, by setting up a known authority to which every member of that society can appeal when he has been harmed or is involved in a dispute, an authority that everyone in the society ought to obey. So any people who don't have such an authority to appeal to, for the settlement of their disputes, are still in the state of nature. Thus, every absolute monarch is in the state of nature with respect to those under his dominion. For an absolute monarch is supposed to have both legislative and executive power in himself alone. So there is no judge or court of appeal that can fairly, impartially, and authoritatively make decisions that could provide relief and compensation for any harm that may be inflicted by the monarch or on his orders. So such a man, call him Tsar or Grand Signor or what you will, is as much in the state of nature with respect to his subjects as he is with respect to the rest of mankind. This is a special case of the state of nature, because between it and the ordinary state of nature there is this difference, a woeful one for the subject, really the slave, of an absolute monarch. In the ordinary state of nature, a man is free to judge what he has a right to, and to use the best of his power to maintain his rights, whereas in an absolute monarchy, when his property is invaded by the will of his monarch, he not only has no one to appeal to, but he isn't even free to judge what his rights are, or to defend them, as though he were a cat or a dog that can't think for itself. He is, in short, exposed to all the misery and inconveniences that a man can fear from someone who is in the unrestrained state of nature, and is also corrupted with flattery and armed with power. If you think that absolute power purifies men's blood and corrects the baseness of human nature, read history, of this or any other age, and you'll be convinced of the contrary. A man who would have been insolent and injurious in the forests of America isn't likely to be much better on a throne, possibly even worse, because as an absolute monarch he may have access to learning and religion that will justify everything he does to his subjects, and have the power of arms to silence immediately all those who dare question his actions. In absolute monarchies, as well in other governments in the world, the subjects can appeal to the law and have judges to decide disputes and restrain violence among the subjects. Everyone thinks this to be necessary, and believes that anyone who threatens it should be thought a declared enemy to society and mankind. But does this come from a true love of mankind and society, and from the charity that we all owe to one another? There is reason to think that it doesn't. There is really no more to it than what any man who loves his own power, profit, or greatness will naturally do to prevent fights among animals that labour and drudge purely for his pleasure and advantage, and so are taken care of, not out of any love the master has for them, but out of his love for himself, and for the profit they bring him. If we ask, what security, what fence do we have to protect us from the violence and oppression of this absolute ruler? The very question is found to be almost intolerable. They are ready to tell you that even to ask about safety from the monarch is an offence that deserves to be punished by death. Between subjects, they will grant, there must be measures, laws, and judges to produce mutual peace and security. But the ruler ought to be absolute, and is above all such considerations, because he has the power to do more hurt and wrong. It is right when he does it. To ask how you may be guarded from harm coming from the direction where the strongest hand is available to do it is to use the voice of faction and rebellion. As if when men left the state of nature and entered into society, they agreed that all but one of them should be under the restraint of laws, and that that one should keep all the liberty of the state of nature increased by power, and made licentious by impunity. This implies that men are so foolish that they would take care to avoid harms from polecats or foxes, but think it is safety to be eaten by lions. But whatever may be soothingly said to confuse people's understandings, it doesn't stop men from feeling. And when they see that any man is outside the bounds of the civil society to which they belong, and that they have no appeal on earth against any harm he may do them, they are apt to think they are in the state of nature with respect to that man, and to take care, as soon as they can, to regain the safety and security in civil society, which was their only reason for entering into it in the first place. This holds for any such man, whatever his station in life, whether he is a monarch or a street sweeper. In the early stages of a commonwealth, it may happen that one good and excellent man comes to be preeminent, his goodness and virtue causing the others to defer to him as to a kind of natural authority, so that by everyone's tacit consent he comes to be the chief arbitrator of their disputes, with their confidence in his uprightness and wisdom as their only guarantee against his abusing that power. The story could unfold from there in the following way. The careless and unforeseeing innocence of those early years creates customs of deference to one individual. Some of the successors to the first preeminent man are much inferior to him, but the passage of time gives authority to customs. Some say it makes them sacred, and so the custom of deference to one remains. Eventually the people find that, although the whole purpose of government is the preservation of property, their property is not safe under this government, and they conclude that they cannot be safe and without anxiety, cannot regard themselves as in a civil society, until the legislative power is given to a collective body of men, call it Senate, Parliament, or what you will. In this way every single person, from the highest to the lowest, comes to be subject to the laws that he himself, as part of the legislature, has established. No one has authority to take himself outside the reach of a law, once it has been made, nor can anyone by any claim of superiority plead exemption from the laws, so as to license offences against it by himself or his dependents. No man in civil society can be exempted from its laws, for if any man can do what he thinks fit, and there is no appeal on earth for compensation or protection against any harm he may do, isn't he still perfectly in the state of nature, and so not a part or member of that civil society? The only way to avoid the answer yes is to say that the state of nature and civil society are one and the same thing. And I have never yet found anyone who is such an enthusiast for anarchy that he would affirm that. End of chapters 6 and 7.